Hey everyone, it's me, W. Kamau Bell. Welcome back to the ACLU's podcast at Liberty.
62, 68, 72, 75, bingo!
These are the words that comedian Phil Baker recited on CBS radio in the mid-1930s. He was listing the ages of the Supreme Court justices, and the network executives censored him for it. At the time, there were pitched protests over what comedy was considered, quote, political, and what made it to air. "This country is in a state of fear," declared ACLU lawyer Morris Ernst. He continued, "This is why we have censorship. It wouldn't surprise me if in the next year the president took over control of all the radio stations." Nearly 100 years later, what constitutes political comedy is still up for debate, and attempts to censor this humor are just as contentious. That's why today we're turning our attention to the history of censorship in comedy and what it reveals about the history and present state of free speech in America. We have two experts joining us. Cliff Nesteroff is a comedian, historian, and author whose books include Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. Also, Cliff is a Canadian, which I'm only saying because it comes up. And Dean Obladiah is a lawyer, comedian, and journalist, and the co-founder of the New York Arab American Comedy Festival, which has been going on for 22 years. All right, we got the setup. Let's get to the jokes. A couple episodes back, I shared with the audience where I was when I found out the Jimmy Kimmel news. Let's start with you guys. So, Cliff, where were you when you found out that first wave of news that Jimmy Kimmel had been suspended indefinitely? Where were you?
I was in the same place I usually am, in bed, in my underwear, trying to log into my email, going through two-factor authentication, three-factor authentication, going crazy, and the Yahoo News had the headline there. I try and ignore the Yahoo News because it's always... It's like reading a tabloid, but that's where I was. But that's where I always am, you know?
When you said Yahoo News, I was like, man, this dude's super old school. He's still got Yahoo News homepage.
Well, I was trying to get into the two-factor authentication, like verify to this account you never use, and then I had to use a phone to get to the laptop and a laptop to get to the other. It was a mess. I was more concerned with myself than Jimmy Kimmel. That's my typical vainglorious method.
Fair. And what about you? What about you, Dean?
I was actually hosting my show. It was my radio show's live, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 nights a week on Sirius XM. And so we were, and that happens often. News breaks a lot in that time slot, like the 6, 7, 8 o'clock hours. So there I am, and I probably was talking to some guest, and I'm completely distracted because I'm reading. Like the person talking about something, whatever's going on, I'm like, Jimmy Kimmel just got suspended. You know what's happening in this country? So I really probably interrupted my guest to break the news while they were sharing something deep and personal about something political that was happening in their lives or something. But that really was live, and it became really distracting because I was like, this is really a bad moment for this country.
Well, we'll talk about that a little more because I think certainly as people who are in the comedy industry, as the three of us are, to whatever extent that we are, it is big. It is huge news for the comedy industry. But then there's also this part of this that this is, you know, obviously the ACLU podcast. How do you explain it to somebody who's just like, who cares what happens to a millionaire talk show host, Dean? How would you explain that?
It's the same way when I talked about Mahmoud Khalil being almost deported for speaking out about Palestine. And I beg people who listen to my show and in my articles, it's not about his views. You could like them or not. It's about if you don't fight each step of the way, it makes it easier for the next person, the next frontier in their efforts to stifle dissent. So when they went after a green card holder, I begged people, I go, it doesn't end with a green card holder. Uh-huh. You know, it ends with rich white guys on TV. No, I didn't say that. I go, it ends, you know, it just comes down to the path. So you've got to continue to fight against these things. So Jimmy Kimmel, if he, the pushback by people to that is what changed the game.
Yeah. And what about you? Because, Cliff, the thing I love about you, and it started happening around the time of the I love a lot of things about you, but the thing I love about you on this subject is that when cancel culture was all the rage, you were like first to be like, we've seen this before in the comedy world. And you started putting up headlines from like newspapers from like the 40s of like Red Skelton being mad about how I can't tell ethnic jokes anymore. And I don't know if it was Red Skelton, but it was comedian too. Oh, good memory for me. But like how there's always a wave in comedy of comedians saying, I can't say the thing I used to say. And so how does this raid, as far as like a comedian being, you know, targeted by the government? How do you put that in your historical comedy?
Well, when I was studying, and I'm always studying sort of the history of show business and the history of comedy, one thing that became apparent during that rage, as you were saying, the cancel culture rage, like 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, a lot of the people that were sounding the bell about cancel culture were connected to like a history of evangelical extremism long before Donald Trump came along, were involved in fighting against Norman Lear and trying to get Norman Lear sitcoms canceled all throughout the 1970s and organizing boycott campaigns against salacious people like B. Arthur, the star of Maude, when they tried to get that show canceled. When this cancel culture thing was percolating, a lot of the people that were sounding the bell were like sort of far-right media personalities saying, it used to be the conservatives, now it's the liberals. And I was kind of saying through the whole time, no, you're still connected to the Heritage Foundation. They were founded in 1973, founded by a guy named Paul Weyrich, co-founded. He later co-founded the Moral Majority. He's the guy who recruited Jerry Falwell into politics and co-founded the Christian Coalition, recruited Pat Robertson into politics. And they were always waging these sort of censorship campaigns. We've got to remove Roseanne from the air because she's kissing a woman on the lips. We've got to remove Ellen DeGeneres from the air. We've got to remove The Adventures of Mighty Mouse, a Saturday morning cartoon on CBS because it promotes cocaine use. And it was canceled because of their pressure. So these same sort of forces and organizations were the ones who were decrying, ah, oh, cancel culture, cancel culture.
Yeah, but I think it is important to say that whatever we're experiencing now in America, there is a trail. Like this is the, you know, I think we often prisoners of the moment or, you know, we can sort of be like, oh, my God, nobody's ever lived through the thing that we're living through. And as I like to say often, a lot of the people who we look at in the black and white photos from the 60s and 50s are still alive. Like, they're, you know, they did. And or they had kids who were active then who are now adults who are now perpetuating. Well, the same
could
thing.
I just interject very briefly, because this is a weird piece of trivia. Joseph McCarthy's speechwriter was a guy named Brent Bazell. He ghostwrote Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, which was a huge book in the early 60s. His son, Brent Bazell Jr., founded this organization to sort of police television and highlight what they considered liberal bias or progressive stuff. So his son was one of the main guys that went after Norman Lear all throughout the 1970s. Brent Bazell III was an evangelical campaigner in the 1990s, and he's responsible in the early 2000s for the hysteria surrounding Janet Jackson's nipple, which nobody cared about until this guy created a groundswell of outrage about it, and he would go on C-SPAN and talk about it. And the whole reason the FCC levied a fine against them was because of this guy's campaigning. His son, Brent Bazell IV, got arrested for storming the Capitol on January 6th.
Wow.
So exactly as you say, there's this sort of like ripple effect through the years. Yeah.
And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon.
That's a lot of Brent Bazells. That's too many Brent Bazells right there.
That's why I don't like you. That's why I don't like you, Cliff. I learned things I didn't know I needed to know. Like, ah. Dean, you just wrote an op-ed about how the Trump administration's war on comedy threatens free speech for us all. Can you talk more about what you see as the, quote, war on comedy?
Sure. I mean, I've co-produced the New York Arab American Comedy Festival here in New York City for 22 years. We did the festival, and Mason Zide co-founded it with me. We did the festival during George Bush's war on terror and all that, and comedians were never concerned about the material they were going to do on stage. In fact, we were proud about using comedy to challenge the administration, to call out what Bush was doing, to call out the war on terror, to call out the Iraq war. There was never even a hint of being that there'd be a backlash or a consequence for that. This is the first festival come out in 22 years that we have comedians and agents who have emailed me concerned about what's going to be said on stage. They, especially ones who are immigrants, who are legal immigrants, like green card holders, concerned about doing any jokes about the Middle East. Some asked us not to put their picture on the flyers and the promotion because they know that we're going to be, our festival is known in a way for going after the leaders, especially if they're on the right wing. And with Zoran's campaign in New York, it added to it, even though we're not a Muslim festival, we're Arab American. So look, this is the first time there's a hesitance and they really worry. And I can't tell the comics come out who are green card holders not to be fearful that if they tell a joke about Trump or Stephen Miller or someone else, that it goes viral on social media and that something happens to them and that they lose their status or it makes it harder to become a citizen. That's the harsh world we live in. But as a being born here in the country of New Jersey, I have the freedom to talk about whatever I want. And I'm going to use my privilege to do it. But, there were times I would tell people, well, you don't have to worry about anything. You can't say that now. Mm-hmm. You do have to worry. And if you're a comedian and you're telling, and I had some agents say, oh, my client is concerned about being in the festival. If people are going to be talking a lot about politics, it's not worth the cost right now for their career, that kind of stuff. I'm like, what is going on? So it's not overblown. It's like so many people bringing this up. And that's what concerns me. And that's why we have to stand up even more. Because when you obey in advance, like Timothy Snyder talks about, when you give in to the wannabe dictator, you're making their job easier. Let them put me in jail, Kamau. Let them put me in camp. I can still do podcasts from camp, I think, somewhere, as long as there's Wi-Fi, right? Yeah. But let them do that. But we're not going to give in on our own. So that's part of the fight. This year, this festival is not just about making people laugh this year. It's about standing up for freedom of expression, because when they take away any of ours, little by little, it chips away at all of our freedoms.
Yeah, I hear you. Although I think that's the calculation that that those of us who are on stage saying things have to make. Like, do I want to go to the camps? How fast do I want to go to the camps? And where do I want to be sat in the camps? In the VIP section?
Is Wi-Fi extra? Is exactly. it included? Like, there's a lot of questions.
Yeah, Camp Plus. So, Cliff, I want to turn to you because I said this a couple times after Kimmel. Like, I used to always say the thing that happened to Lenny Bruce being arrested on stage for saying something, that's not going to happen anymore. Like, I used to say, like, there's no way that a comic gets arrested on stage for just what they say. I don't know about that anymore. And I want you to speak to that, too, because when you wrote your book, Outrageous, you talked about how, as much as things seem bad today, we have more freedom of expression than ever. Do you think that's still true?
I still think it is true for the time being, but you got to understand how recent so-called free speech is. Now, let's take the Jimmy Kimmel example, okay? So we all, we're up in arms, oh, how could they do this, blah, 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 freedom of speech. It's relatively recent history that the late night comedy shows have devoted so much time to politics. In previous generations, if Johnny Carson made a joke about it or Letterman made a joke about it, it didn't encompass the whole show. And there sort of was still a residual taboo. You know, Johnny Carson, Bob Hope's an even better example. He was a political comedian in the 40s, 50s, 60s, but his jokes were making fun of Eisenhower's golf game. They didn't talk about his foreign policy. So things have opened up in that regard. You could actually criticize a president's foreign policy openly on network television, and that used to be a big taboo. Jimmy Kimmel still can't say fuck on the air. Yeah. So there is not total freedom of speech. So I think it is still true that we have more freedom of speech than ever, but maybe that's not saying a ton considering how little there has been up to this point. And we kind of, people don't understand history. They go, oh, you used to be able to say everything. No, really, you used to be able to say almost nothing. If you look at most of the 20th century, the big taboos were mocking religion, making fun of politics, swearing, expressing sexuality. All of those things are pretty much acceptable now. In varying degrees. And like I say, there had always been these campaigns against things like Mighty Mouse and Three's Company. And going back, I love collecting old TV guides just to read the letters to the editor where they're complaining about I Love Lucy because they had an episode where she has a baby. And they're like, this is disgusting. If we wanted to expose our children to this kind of filth, we'd take them to a burlesque house. How dare she? But once there's distance from the present time, you can look back a few years later, and not even decades later, we can look back at how serious Jerry Falwell was when he was campaigning against the Teletubbies in the early 2000s. It's just so funny and ridiculous and absurd. And these types of absurd types have a lot of power and control right now. So they are ripe to be mocked and not taken seriously, even though, you got to take them seriously. But you know what I mean? It's not...
No, I know what you mean. I mean... I grew up in that era, so I, and not that I was around for this, but, when you talk about I Love Lucy, I think for your average Gen Z kid, they don't understand that, like, they on I Love Lucy, Lucy and Desi slept in separate beds in their bedroom so that the viewing audience wouldn't get to think that they maybe ever had sex to make that baby. beds side by side in their own bedroom. All healthy married couples do.
Yeah, and famously, the word pregnant was not allowed in any of the scripts. The network and the sponsor said, you can't say pregnant, it'll conjure people's minds of how that happened. Mm-hmm. So you have to say expecting. And then the joke was that Desi Arnaz had specting with an apostrophe, you know, in front of it.
So then we get a little bit of a little bit of ethnic humor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I love that designation of ethnic humor.
You know, to Cliff's point, there's always been pressure by consumers and even organizations about speech they didn't like. What we're living through is an administration weaponizing the government to silence people. That's different. And look, you know, I wrote about this in the past. I mean, Richard Nixon pressured CBS to get rid of the Smothers Brothers. The Smothers Brothers, Tom and Dick, will tell you they got fired because Richard Nixon didn't like the jokes about them. But then there was that lull. We didn't have that again. We had presidents go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and laugh at themselves and have no problem until Donald Trump. And then Donald Trump, even when he was running in 2016, called for Saturday Night Live to be canceled and about a month before the election in writing, saying they should be retired. And I wrote about it then going, this is really alarming, folks. We've never had a presidential candidate call for a comedy show to be canceled. Then he doesn't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner because he doesn't want to be laughed at. So then you get to, in his first term, he called in writing for the FCC to investigate SNL and late night hosts. He railed against them. This time's different. It's no longer words. It's actions. And Brendan Carr, the FCC chair, before he got rid of Jimmy Kimmel, he was on CNBC because I played it on my show going, this is concerning because they asked Brendan Carr about late night shows. And he goes, look, all of them have to change. And that was before. So they are not hiding it. So to me, the difference is now you're always going to have people upset in organizations and they'll say things about a TV show or a comedian. Now we have to worry about the apparatus of the government using to silence us, which is much worse than it's been in a long time. So this is, yes, it's a repeat of Nixon, but it is more frightening because there's no constraints on Donald Trump's ambitions to silence dissent he doesn't like.
Yeah, I think that is the difference, Dean, is that, and you brought it up, Cliff, the idea of the letter to the editor used to be a thing that we as a culture laughed at. And the person who got their letter in the TV guide or the newspaper felt like, I've accomplished something just by seeing my words in print. And that's sort of where it ended a lot of the time. Like, but now the letter to the editor is in the White House. You know what I mean? Like, it's the idea that, like, okay, we'll print this idea that seems whatever, like criticizing this TV show. But now the guy in the White House is doing letters to the editor every day, all day long. Cliff, earlier you went through, I just want to sort of connect these ideas, these shows, like reasons why, whatever the movements were, why would they want to cancel Norman Lear? Like the specific things they were mad about his shows about. Why would they want to cancel Be Author?
So the campaign against Norman Lear was similar. It was like concerned parents for clean television, citizens for a moral America, you know, things like that. All with these euphemistic names, and they just hate. They thought All in the Family was communist propaganda. They're opposed to Maude because they famously did a episode about abortion, which was extremely daring to do a comedy. It was a two-part episode about abortion. A lot of the affiliates, just like the Jimmy Kimmel thing, dropped the show, wouldn't air those episodes, put on a rerun of some milquetoast thing in its place, and so. Those sitcoms that Norman Lear produced, especially the first handful, intentionally sort of had these progressive themes and realistic themes running through them. The 60s sitcom, for the most part, were fantasy-based sitcoms. Mr. Ed about a talking horse, Bewitched about being married to a witch, I Dream of Jeannie about a guy who has a thing with a genie in a bottle, the Munsters, the Addams Family. These are all unrealistic.
Father Knows Best, another fantasy.
Well, that's the 50s, so that was a different style. Yeah. Okay. You had Make Room for Daddy, you had I Love Lucy, the domestic sitcom, which was sort of like a fictionalized, I mean, all show business is a fictionalized version of reality, but those were, of course, very white bread. Yeah. There were no minorities in those shows, you know, quite intentionally based on the sponsors' wishes. In the 60s, it was fantasy sitcoms. In the 70s, film and television became far more realistic. And so Norman Lear, within the confines of network television, to the most he could push it, introduced very serious subject matter, realistic subject matter into comedy on television, scripted comedy. That had not happened before. And it's one of the reasons his shows, his early shows especially, became huge hits and he became a huge television mogul. And it was considered a threat to this sort of culture of bigotry that had basically controlled television in the 50s and 60s. If a sponsor said, we do not want a black actor on this show, there would not be a black actor on that show. And Norman Lear was the opposite. He comes along, it's going to be only black actors on this show. And you can sponsor it or not sponsor it, but that's the way it is. And once you have a hit show within the industry, that's all you really need. You have far more license. If those shows were poorly rated, he wouldn't have had the clout to sort of push the envelope as it was. So Norman Lear was considered a threat because he was packaging progressive politics in comedy, making it palatable for people who may be apolitical, and sort of giving them a moral of sorts that was appealing and that people could relate to, and that rang true. And there's no greater enemy to the bigot than the truth. So he was extremely controversial for that reason, and extremely successful. And also, he hired the best comedy writers in the industry. Let's not forget, these shows were actually really good. Yeah. If they had sucked and if they weren't funny, then they would be meaningless. But he was able to curate, you know, all these people he had worked with in the 50s and 60s when he was writing sort of fantasy comedy, and hired them to work on All in the Family. And it was, you know, groundbreaking and influential. And we still talk about it to this day.
Because you were talking about how white television was in the early days. Ironically, Danny Thomas is Lebanese.
There you go.
And he had Uncle Tanous. He had an Arab character on the show. And Danny Thomas's real name is very Arab. And so there's the one of the origins of American TV is a Lebanese-American guy who spoke Arabic, who did an Arabic character on the show long before Rami Yusuf, long before Mo'amer did any of this. And it's funny how then it took so many years later, decades later, for another Arab-American to actually star who was Arab and known as Arab. There are plenty of Arab Americans and people didn't know it. Like Tony Shalhoub was on Wings playing an Italian American guy, you know? Yeah. But like Tony Shalhoub was the next generation, then Jamie Farr on MASH, Arab American, but people didn't know he was Arab American. It took all those decades later for the Arab Americans to finally start.
Shaggy on Scooby-Doo, Casey Kasem.
Oh, yeah.
Casey Kasem. Oh, Casey Kasem. Right.
I always thought Shaggy was Arab American because it was Casey Kasem's voice.
I like that. Yeah, that's very good. So we had that. And also, and look at Norman Lear. He founded People for the American Way in 1981 in response to the efforts to silence him and autocrats. People for American Way is still around. Yeah. I mean, I still deal with that organization. They're doing great work. But so here's a guy who didn't cower from the fight. He leaned into it to start an organization to stand up for freedom of speech, stand up for the right to challenge people in power. And especially in the, you look at the People for American Way, their website, because I just checked it. It said it was founded in 1981 to push back against those who were trying to silence dissent. And here he was using comedy to do that. But he got serious and did an actual organization to fight the fight as well.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that brings up an interesting point. So as you so well put so well, Cliff, that like, Norman Lear's shows were hit shows. They were like the biggest shows on TV. There's black people of a certain generation where if you put the Jeffersons down, they will physically fight you. they will actually engage in fisticuffs over slander.
They turn into George Jefferson with his little
They turn into George Jefferson. So, and the reason he was able to, like you say, break those barriers in large part was because he was making shows that were printing money. Okay, so that's what we have on one hand. Therefore, Norman Lear becomes one of the biggest TV producers in the history of Hollywood, but certainly the biggest TV producer at that time in the 70s and 80s. And then, as you said, Dean, he then founds this organization to do the activism work that he is alluding to in his show, but he's not going to do it on the show. Because the funny thing about those shows is nobody could accuse them of being woke in the way we think of woke right now, but they were addressing issues of the day in a progressive way, but they weren't, you know, we think of woke as sort of being like buttoned up. They were not buttoned up.
Well, I just wanted to interject and say that one of the reasons Norman Lear founded People for the American Way is because he saw that the evangelical campaign against his shows was not just a letter to the editor. It was an organized campaign by evangelical lobby groups. And many of those players are still involved in the political scene today, the evangelical extremist scene. So very early on, Norman Lear was aware of that. And whereas other people thought it was just cranky people complaining or a mother, a concerned parent, Norman Lear saw that. And that's why the People for the American Way was founded, to create his own sort of think tank to push back against the one that was trying to demonize him.
Well, that's what I want to lead to is like, Dean, the question is, are the people in power in show business, specifically the comedy voices who are in power, doing enough now the way that Norman Lear, and I would also, in his own, I would throw in Dick Gregory was like another person who's like, I'm a comedian over here and I'm an activist over right. here. Like, I have to do both those jobs to feel like I'm doing the right work. Are comedians today doing enough work, either whether it's on in their work or off stage, doing enough to push back against? And I'm talking about the powerful comedians. I'm not talking about right. little people like me.
Look, I think the same of comics 20 years ago, 100 years ago, whenever stand-up comedy really became an art form, maybe 50s and 60s now, there's Lenny Bruces who are going to stand up and challenge the powers that be and be willing to go to jail and their entire career over, and others who are going to sell out and never do that. So I don't know the ones that I could be upset with. I kind of cheer the ones who are standing up. Could they do more? They could always do more. But how do I get them, Kim Al?
I think during that wave, that cancel culture obsession, when the media was just repeating it over and over and over, and there are all these think pieces, comedians, you know, self-centered narcissists mostly, no self-awareness. We're philosophers. We're truth tellers.
Yeah.
And then when push comes to shove, when they need to perceive reality, they can't see yeah. it, you know.
Yeah.
So I think comics bought into their own horseshit. Oh, I'm a philosopher. Yeah. I must always be profound.
Poet.
I'm smarter than yeah. you. I'm yeah. wise. Yeah. And yeah. no, you've been duped.
Yeah, and there's, I think there are a few stand-up comedians in the history of stand-up comedy who you would put that truth teller label on. And the funny thing is, most of those comics wouldn't want to take it. Like, you know, like George Carlin doesn't want to take the truth teller label. Lenny Bruce probably didn't want it, I would assume. But it's the comics who are now championing that label.
And what was there, you know, this is sort of, I'm not referring to anybody specifically, but during that wave, what was the definition of a truth teller? Somebody who was, bold enough to use slurs? Oh, what a great comic you are.
So I'm going to use a name, not because I think there's, like Dean, you just said, there's the kind of comic who's like, I'm not interested in the fight, I'm just telling jokes, which can be fine because mm-hmm. it could, you know, it could be a comic who's telling just, you know, like I think about like Brian Regan, you know, just yeah. like, I'm just telling mm-hmm. jokes.
Stephen Wright.
Then there's a kind of comic. Right. Yeah. Stephen Wright. Right. Then there's a kind of comic who's like, I'm a, like you were talking about, Cliff, I'm a truth teller. I speak truth to power. But then when power offers me a check, I turn the power off. Like, I can't go take the check. And you know, but, and then there's the comics, like, you know, we talk about like Norman Lear or Dick Gregory, who are like, I do the work on stage and off stage. What about the comics who are just doing the work? Like, I'm thinking about the powerful, like the comics who have the money, the influence. Okay, I will say it, like somebody like the South Park guys, where it's like they are speaking truth to power in their show, but famously apolitical off the show. You know what I mean? But famously sort of like not in any way, like I'm not, maybe they donate to causes, but they're not like, they're not doing the Norman Lear thing. You know, they're not like, and now here's an organization to stand up for free speech. At least they're not doing it publicly. What do you think about comics who are only doing the work and doing good work, but only doing it in the work and not doing it outside of the work?
But what's more important, Kamau? That's the question, right? The reason Norman Lear's shows, like All in the Family, were viewed as a threat is because they were wildly popular. They were coming to people's living room. They were touching people. If I gave a speech about, let's say, you know, anti-Muslim bigotry, how many people are going to come? They self-select. But you do a stand-up comedy and you have a show that's successful, be it Rami Yusuf or Muammar, it reaches more people. And whenever things are a threat, so I think, to me, if they want to do things behind the scenes, Kamau, nobody's perfect. I mean, you're kind of perfect, Kamau, because I know you for a long time. Now, you know, Harry's perfect. But the point is, how much can you demand of the comics? My philosophy is this. I applaud them for doing the right thing whenever they do it. They do it both on stage and off stage. Amazing. That's a remarkable person. But getting out in the public and doing things is how you reach people. If you want to effectuate change, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that... obviously, organization is key, and you don't organize in stand-up. The thing, I mean, I'm talking specifically about stand-up, and I know there's other genres of comedy, but stand-up is a solitary pursuit. In order to push back about things like this, you have to be in large, organized groups, you know, strength and power, and a comedian is just one voice. And so, also, I personally, and again, during the cancel culture wave and the first Trump administration, nobody wanted to hear this. But my argument was that things don't change just because a comedian talks about them on stage. It might inform you. It might entertain you. It doesn't change anything. Boy, people did not want to hear that.
That's so funny because like, that's so.
They were like, they're going to.
John Stewart should run for president.
Yeah. When Donald Trump was elected for the first time, Seth Meyers went on, did a monologue, and he looked into the camera and said, "I'm watching you," to Donald Trump. Oh, ooh, ooh. He'll be very scared. Like, it's a little bit of self-importance in comedy sometimes, thinking that we're going to help and change and save and we're the only ones that can do it. No, you're on stage
alone. We're on the front
lines.
We're on the front lines. That's why we call you all civilians who aren't in stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes that's overstated the strength of comedy. And even Dick Gregory, and because, again, people, when I would make that argument almost 10 years ago, people would be like, well, what about Dick Gregory? And I would have to say, and as much as I love Dick Gregory, Dick Gregory, at the height of his fame, it coincided with the civil rights movement. He started bailing on gigs, and his agents were furious, and his managers, because he'd be booked at the Crescendo on the Sunset Strip for, you know, $5,000, and then he wouldn't be there. He'd be in Birmingham in a march, and he said, this is more important. And so all these, like, cockamamie comics would have to come in, fill in at the last second. It was like the kind of a hilarious kind of booking. But Dick Gregory himself said that he had to be there in person doing the activism, and that, to him at the time, was more important than comedy. And eventually— around 1969-70, you didn't see Dick Gregory performing in nightclubs. He mostly was performing at rallies, doing lectures and campuses, and mostly talking about politics very seriously and just a few jokes here and there. So even he realized that he couldn't affect that much change on the stage. Now, I would argue that he did affect change from the stage just by virtue of who he was doing what he was in that time period. There were no other black comics in the mainstream yet, and he blew it wide open. And a lot of the old school Chitlin comic guys resented that because they were way older than him and never became as famous as him. You know, Dick Gregory was profiled in Time magazine, Life magazine. You know, he was the top comedian of 1961. He went from making like $50 a gig to $5,000 a gig in less than 1 year. And he was one of the first. I have said in the past that he was the first, but I think one of the first black comics to cross over and to regularly perform for white audiences. And he was talking about bigotry, racism, the civil rights movement to white audiences and making them laugh. And so that was revolutionary, but it didn't stop bigots in the South. It did not have as much impact, of course, as the civil rights movement. And so he knew that and saw that and sort of made a switch. So even he, Dick Gregory, this great activist comic, knew that comedy alone was not enough to affect change.
I will say, you know, with Jon Stewart, I interviewed Jon Stewart for a documentary I made called The Muslims Are Coming with my friend Nagin Farsad like 12 years ago. We interviewed him. And we asked him about, do you think your comedy's had an impact on things? And he said, no. And I thought he was being humble. And we pushed him a little, not like hard, but it's like, what do you mean? And he listed the issues that were important to him. He like big money out of politics, over sensationalized media, that kind of stuff. He goes, nothing has changed. And this was when he was still on The Daily Show, when he was at the height.
Yeah, this
of
is
his
the, this is the initial Jon Stewart run on The Daily Show, not the new
right. This
Pope,
is when Jon Stewart,
not the new
right?
Pope Jon Stewart.
It was huge. Like, so, and that made me think about it. And he's right. He understood. He did not, on his own, effectuate change. But I do believe comedians, just like any form of art, can wake people up to an issue they've never heard about, at least introduce them to. It's like the gateway drug to maybe changing things. That's the hope.
They can especially be effective, I think, on young people, like really young people. So when I first heard George Carlin, when I was a teenager, I was like, oh my God, he's like speaking the truth. I could relate to this exactly. And it probably did affect my political outlook. Also music, you know, when you're a teenager, you get into music. If it's punk rock, I got into Frank Zappa and his philosophy was a big influence on me. That's where you influence people, is at that age, you know, the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, when people are first starting to get interested in politics, music, film, things like that. You can sort of affect a person's point of view at that point. But once it's a person in their 40s, 50s, 60s, it's
they just want to laugh before they go to sleep at night. They're
I think comedy it can only affect sort of superficial change, not in the political landscape. If you look at The Daily Show, huge influence, but not on politics, on the look of comedy. All the late night shows are sort of a a Daily Show junior now with a news image in the corner of the screen, talking politics, you know, fake correspondence, and then all these sort of unofficial spinoffs, John Oliver and Samantha Bee when she had her show, Larry Wilmore when he had his show, and countless others. So it has influence that way, you know, in a very sort of superficial, stylistic way, as opposed to change.
As opposed to the as opposed to influencing. I agree 100% with all that. My question is, I feel like one place that comedians do, and this is sort of seems to have been true in the history of this country, have an effect of expanding the bounds of freedom of expression and making sure that we don't lose it. I feel like that's the thing. I feel like if you sort of get to like where comedians doing the big work, because I, you know, I sort of have that philosophy of like, I don't agree with what every comic says on stage, like, but, right. and I might criticize it, but I'm not going to say you shouldn't say it necessarily. I'm just going to say, you know, on some level, it's like, okay, I don't like that joke about those people that you keep doing in every special. I'm going to be public about that, but I'm not going to say we need to stop you from saying those things out loud, because I feel like that's where comics are actually beneficial, is to keeping testing the bounds of freedom of expression. What do you think about that?
Are you saying, though, as a comedian, you personally would not say something about a comedian or say, don't do a joke like that?
No, no, no. I'm not. I can say I don't like that joke. I can say that joke sucks. I can say that joke as a comedian. I can say we can have back and forth comedically about it, or we can have. Sure. But I'm not going to say we should stop that. I'm not going to get to the point of like necessarily saying you should not be allowed to say that.
I understand. I don't think any comedian. Right. So I think comedy is this pure form of freedom of expression. You get on stage every night in this city. I live in New York City. You can see so much free speech on display, but it changes their freedom depending on their fame. There are things people say on stages in New York that are awful, to be blunt, right? Yeah. And they're not famous. No one records it, so nothing happens. Some of them, so yeah, you can say it, but there's going to be a consequence for
you. You still have to deal with the consequence, but you don't have to deal with the government.
Right, and that's the world we live in. That's different. That's the whole thing, Kamau. That's the difference. Like, we're all used to living in this world where an audience might not like you, but you can find your own audience. Yeah. We're living in a world where parents might not like you, an organization might not like you. Here you have the FCC chair saying, we're going to look into you. Donald Trump signing executive orders, going after people, where there's really a fear among some comedians about what should we say. And to me, the greatest concern, Kamau, is self-censorship. Yeah. It's not a comedian not doing the joke. It's just not going as far, or maybe not doing that punchline that day because they know there could be a backlash, and it's not a commercial backlash, which is always a concern. It's a governmental backlash where you're going to suffer. And that's the concern. And then somebody might not want to book you. That's the other part of it. They go, this guy's really political. And, you know, the administration is tough now on politics. I'm not going to book this guy. I'll get him next year or something like that. Yeah. So that's where it plays a role commercially. So, yeah, I think comedians can play a role in it. But I think we're in a new time that we've not lived through as adults ourselves, where we have to fear the government coming after us.
Cliff.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I was just sort of daydreaming about how if I had all the power, I would blacklist every comedian who has ever done a Christopher Walken impression on stage.
That's a lot of comedians.
Man, that's like a that's really
that's
like
horrible.
Wiping the it's clean.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
A
why would you do that?
I know,
that's
this
just
where,
wrong.
This is where I
why would you do
this
that?
This is where I depart from the ACLU philosophy. Suppress it.
It's very specific. Cliff doesn't like censorship except for Chris Walken impressions.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Remember they were the Boone? That and Cosby impressions.
Yeah.
Back when I was doing stand-up, it was Crocodile Hunter. Every hack did an impression of Crocodile Hunter. It was just an Australian accent. It was never an impression. Yeah. And it was just by crikey. And the audience would laugh every fucking time. And I would be in a rage at the back of the room.
I embarrassingly came up during the era of comedy where every comedian had to have, at one point, have a punchline that was Yokiro Taco Bell. That was the era that I came up in.
Oh, Yokiro Taco Bell.
Every comic
Bell.
Had to at some point
that.
Hit that Yokiro Taco Bell thing or you
it
weren't really
commercial.
Doing comedy. Yeah, yeah. Before we go, a few speed round questions. Dean, if listeners remember one thing from this conversation, what should it be?
That free speech is precious and we have to fight for it every day.
Your turn, Cliff.
Well, if they can see it, it's about how badass I look in this Rocky the Flying Squirrel ball cap. But if it's...
they can't see it.
Oh, well, I'm wearing a Rocky the Flying Squirrel ball cap and it looks pretty badass for those listeners who cannot see what's going on. One takeaway is get off of social media. You don't need it. It is making you believe things that are not true. It's making you concerned about things you shouldn't be concerned about and ignore things you should be concerned about. And we carry it around with us in our pocket. And whenever we're waiting in line, we absorb it and force ourselves for some reason or have conditioned ourselves to consume it over and over and over all day long.
Next lightning round question, which you sort of answered, get off social media, but I will tell you what. So is there anything you think listeners should do, Dean, after this conversation?
Get active in real things outside of the social media in the real world.
Just go see a live comedy show. That's the thing.
Exactly.
People,
Jerry, if you're not in New York, go support live comedy. We need it. It might be the last bastion before the camps.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sort of like a outside observer, you know, or at least I try to be, even though I, you know, I provide the context and the history. And then I, you know, Americans can do what they want with that information. They can weaponize it. They can use it to win arguments, to be motivated. I can't do anything that would result in potential arrest. So even participating in physical protests for me, if I get arrested, even if I didn't do anything illegal and they let me go, it's still grounds for deportation. And that was true when I moved here when Obama was president. That's not a new thing.
But probably not weaponized in the same way under Obama.
Well, it's a violation of my work visa and it would be revoked and I'd be kicked out no matter what. So I have to be, I can't physically put myself on the ground. I could, but then I would just probably be gone, you know? So I try and provide context and information and I consider that my role as a non-American here, you know?
Yes. Both of you, just this, then we'll let you go. One thing that you like, a piece of comedy or a stand-up comedian, somebody that you like that you think needs more attention that you would recommend that they can go, that listeners here can go look at as soon as they get off of this podcast. Dean, some can be a new comedian, could be an older comedian, a classic comedy that you're like, go check that out. That makes me laugh.
There's a comedian, Mohamed El Sheikhli, who's in our comedy festival. He's a Libyan immigrant. He's only been here for a few years. He's already killing it. This guy, English is like an eighth language or something. And he is really funny. And you're like, how did you do this? How are you better than me? And you only speak English for like 6 years. So Mohamed El Sheikhli, who used to write for Samantha Bee's show, really, I think up and coming, is going to be a star.
All right. What about you, Sir Cliff? You can go, and you know a lot of classic comedy.
Well, yeah, I'll go back to Dick Gregory. His first album, or one of his first albums, called In Living Black and White, is a great time capsule. It requires knowledge of the civil rights movement if you don't have that context. But if you do have that context of the civil rights movement and realize that this record, this nightclub recording, was made during the height of that, and realize that there had never been a black comic addressing a white audience, a mainstream audience, a non-Chitlin Circuit audience, about these issues, it's really quite interesting and powerful and fascinating, not just listening to what he's talking about, but to hear the audience's reaction to it. So Dick Gregory in Living Black and White, one of his first records, is really worth a listen.
All right. Thank you, guys. I appreciate that. I'm going to let you go. I know you both have other things to do. I appreciate the time, and good luck with the Comedy Festival. And good luck with your next book, Cliff. I don't know what it is, but you're always writing a book.
So
good luck with that next book.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks again to our guests, Cliff and Dean. And thank you for listening. Would you like another hour of Comedy Talk? Check out our episode from this summer, recorded live at Series Fest. In it, comedian Mo Fry Pasek, host of the podcast Worse Than You, interviewed me about my comedy journey and what it means to be a sociopolitical comedian. And remember, friends, friends help friends stay in the fight. Join us! Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't already, rate the show and leave us a review. And you can also tell us what's giving you hope right now. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU in conjunction with Who Knows Best Productions, which is Melissa Hudson-Bell, PhD, and me. For the ACLU, our senior executive producer is Sam Riddell. Our executive producer is Jessica Herman-Weitz. And our intern is Maude V. Kianra. At Liberty is produced and edited by Erica Ghetto and Mariah Gossett for Good Get. And this episode was recorded at the Great Skyline Studios in Oakland, California. Brian! Until next time, I'm your host, W. Kamau Bell.